All right, good evening, everyone. This is part two of our series on man's place in the universe. Those who were here last week may recognize the source sheets, but they've gotten a little bit thicker. If you weren't here last week, you're going to be fine. Don't worry about it. And just to briefly sum up, essentially, we saw that that with regard to man's place in the universe, there really is a fundamental conflict. There's a real fundamental problem that over the course of so many generations, it was taken for granted that, first of all, physically, geographically, human beings, and by extension, Mother Earth, are at the center of all existence. The geocentric model of the universe essentially took this for granted. If you take a look, for example, I actually added this time. It's a little bit hard to make out, but just to give you a sense, on the third side of the sheet, I gave you the classic model of the geocentric model of the universe, and it doesn't exactly look like our version of the solar system, but just the notion that, and that's Earth, it's just giving you multiple views, but it's the notion that really we are indeed at the center, the Earth is at the center, and then in various ways, human beings are at the center of the universe. And if we are physically at the center of the universe, so then by extension, we can make the argument, as we saw Sadhguru makes last week as well, so then, right, then in terms of the value or sort of the larger place of mankind, we really are where it's at. We're really where what it's all about. So that's sort of the assumption in sort of broad strokes for so long. And that has Jewish analogs as well, this notion that we are the crown jewel and all of that. Problem is that in modern times, this picture, with all respect, no longer stands. We've been enlightened as to our insignificance. We know that Earth, believe it or not, is not. I know this is not what you came to the show to hear. You may have heard this rumor circulating, so just wanted to confirm for you that Judaism also agrees that indeed the world is, or Earth is, or the solar system is heliocentric, that the sun does not revolve around us, but the other way around. We've finally come around. They've convinced us we're no longer in the Middle Ages, as it were. And that has not only physical ramifications, but sort of cosmological ones, but it has dramatic implications in terms of how we think about the place of human beings. And it raises real serious issues, real problems. And the question is sort of, how does Judaism respond? And as we saw last time, even within the earlier sources, this was a conflict, and this was a real question. So we had Saadia saying that everything in the world is created for the sake of man, and the Rambam pushes back and says, not so fast, not so simple. So this is already a struggle even prior to the modern period, but especially after the modern period. And it's not just the question of where we are physically in the universe, right? There's a lot more. What other modern findings would you recommend? We started talking about a little bit last week, but didn't flesh some of them out. Bring into question our place, our standing, our physical standing, our ethical standing, our goodness, a sense of pride and sort of confidence in man, in humanity.
If everything boils down to genes, and even on a nano level that we haven't even discovered yet, that could, I don't think it's necessarily so, but that certainly could raise the whole question of free will. We don't have a spiritual part. Right. You know, we're moved, you know, somebody is mentally ill because of certain chemicals in his or her blood.
Sure.
That's certainly a possible
change. 100%. So the way that we view medication, and it's part of the larger genetic revolution, really. Right? That's the genetic revolution, the neuroscientific revolution, right? If we're just a bunch of chemicals, and you can correct that with changing the chemical balance, so that raises questions about free will. If our genetics make us predisposed to certain kinds of behaviors, so that has ramifications as well. What about other theories? What about, for example, Darwin? Where does that play into all of this?
Well, it would be kind of odd to say, if you believe that man is an evolved form of being, then it's sort of hard to say, it sort of makes it harder to say that man is the center, because it sort of seems like, you know, that God didn't sort of create us out of nothing. mm-hmm. to put us in the center. Mm-hmm. We evolved into being. It just makes it seem less, you know, I don't know, clear.
Yeah, it's less plausible or less likely to claim that everything is about humanity if, right, at some point in the past. And by the way, have we finished evolving? Is this it?
Looks
I don't
like
mean to. I don't mean to. For example, okay, just open the newspaper and. Okay, it's more about ISIS today, so not much to write home about in terms of the evolution of of mankind, for sure. And what about other aspects of Darwin's theory or extensions of that? Right. So, for example, how do we survive? What are the principles by which we determine where evolution goes? Yeah. So, where does survival of the fittest? What does that tell us about? Right? Is it the ethical standing of humanity that it assures and ensures our perpetuity?
But
right?
Even Peter Singer, whom you mentioned last time.
Yes.
By the way, did you know that he's a child of survivors?
Yes, I do know that.
I was really amazed.
It's anyway, a complicated world.
It's a very complicated.
Yeah.
But even Peter Singer, who is now atheist.
Yeah.
His theory of ethics is that ethics evolved the minute there were two people in the cave.
Mm-hmm.
In that, meaning that cooperation and not just survival of the fittest is necessary for survival.
That's what they say that.
And unfortunately, some people report that is also, I mean, yeah, we had the whole landscape, but that also happened in the camps.
Yeah.
That it wasn't, you know, apart from luck and this, that, and the other thing.
Yeah.
So I'm just commenting that it's not.
It's not as simple
as
it sounds.
Right? It's not exclusive.
It's a great point. Yeah, 100%. And I would just add that I think that there are other aspects. I mentioned the genetic revolution. Mentioned, you know, these are they raise questions, I think, about the standing of man, the ethical standing of man. Then I think in the 20th century, I think that there is a trauma that has come to the Western world after multiple world wars. And I think that the Western civilization is asking questions about its own moral standing and really struggling with that at a time when Western civilization is increasingly under extremely aggressive attack, whether it was during the Cold War or now, of course, in terms of Islamic radicalism. But we're grappling with our own standing, and that's a really hard place to be when there are people who are out to get you and not necessarily seeing your struggle as anything other than a sign of weakness. So I think there are complicated questions that we've been grappling with sort of on the theoretical levels and in terms of just the outcome of some of the events of the 20th century that really raise these questions. And the question is, in modern times and in general, how does Judaism respond? Do more modern thinkers account for this? Do we see this as somehow more complicated? Not to necessarily go to the opposite extreme, which some mentioned Peter Singer, professor from Princeton, who goes, as we mentioned last time, goes to the opposite extreme and has a much smaller gap than I think anything Judaism could ever accept between, let's say, humans and animals. And by the way, I'll say something that will... It's never a popular thing to say, because who wants to say something, you know, not so friendly about Disney? Because everyone loves Disney. But I'm going to go out on a limb, because you all know me well. And hopefully by this time, you'll take it in a larger context. And I'll say that, I'll be honest, when I see, I love the Disney, there's some wonderful, sweet movies out there. But it gets complicated when you personify animals. I don't know, maybe I'm the only one out there, but to me, there's, it just raises questions about animals and human beings. I just think it's something to ask about. I love Disney. Again, I don't have anything against them. It's interesting to me to just think about, is the uniqueness of a human being, qua human, is that just cute? Maybe it's just cute and there's nothing more there. I don't know. But is the uniqueness of a human being, is that a message that sort of is conveyed in a healthy sense, not in a way that involves egotism or arrogance or anything terrible like that, in a sensitive and humble way, but is popular media, and sort of are the messages out there at least supporting the notion that the human being is a special individual and is qualitatively different, we believe, than the animal kingdom. So I don't know. I don't have a bone to pick with them, per se. But
well, in Disney, often the human being is, can be evil.
It could be even worse.
Yeah. No, not a number of the movies, they are.
Right.
Jungle Book, I guess.
Yeah, and Bambi, and the fish one.
Finding Nemo. Not all man is evil.
Not all man. Well, like Cinderella is interesting because you have she's good, but the only ones who are with Cinderella, the only other human beings, I mean, within her orbit. I don't mean the prince, and that's sort of like I think, and you know, an extension. But in her world are the mice and the right. It's just it's interesting. I don't know. So I really don't mean this as a screed, but it's something to think about. It's obviously not meant perniciously, but it's something to think about. Do we really educate to this notion that the human being is it really is different? So the opposite extreme we would never go to, and I think it's extremely important to educate from a young age to the sense of the capacity of humanity, and therefore, right. The responsibility as well that comes along with it. There's no question. But in light of some of these modern findings, are there ways to sort of, are there more nuanced positions out there? And can we somehow hold both of these views, the greatness of man and yet a sense of humility in both hands somehow at the same time? There were relatively modern thinkers who didn't necessarily see that as necessary and just went full force. So, for example, if you take a look at the third side right there with the under the picture, I have a very small citation from Rav Chaim Avolozhin. This is a classic theological work, the Nefesh HaChaim, very often studied in the world of yeshivot, although in the yeshivas there are four volumes, four sections, gates to the Nefesh HaChaim, and usually the most commonly studied section is section 4, what they call Sha'ar Dalet. And Sha'ar Dalet, he is, anyone know? Nefesh HaChaim, Rav Chaim Avolozhin. He's the founding rabbi of Avolozhin. So let's say early 19th century, okay? 18th to early 19th century. And he is he's a student of the Vilna Gaon. He's one of the primary students of the Vilna Gaon. He's essentially roughly, more or less, the founding Rosh Yeshiva, rabbi and leader of the Yeshiva Avolozhin. Essentially, he built it into the institution that it became in many respects. And it's interesting, in the Yeshivot, they generally study the fourth section, which is about Torah study and the significance and centrality of Torah study, and then sort of goes on. And that's really, in many ways, an anti-Hasidic perspective, because essentially what he's doing, his Rebbe, the Vilna Gaon, was extremely antagonistic toward Chassidut, the famous letter. He refused to meet with the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rav Shneur Zalman Eliadi, and others as well. He just Shem Tov, very negative relationships with the founders of Chassidut. Rav Chaim Avolozhin philosophically strongly opposed to them, but he takes a softer tack. There's actually an interesting discussion why he took a different tack. Is it because they already established, and so he had lost, essentially, and so you're not going to try to stop it, so you just state your position and leave it there. Some say he had a softer personality than his mentor, than the Vilna Gaon, and so he took a little bit of a different approach. So there he discusses the importance of Torah study, and he said this whole notion of dvikut, of cleaving. He's very critical of the notion of just study, which is ecstatic, which is not intellectually rigorous, which he ascribes to the founders of the Hasidic movement. I think some of them might have pushed back and said that that's an unfair caricature, but that's sort of one of the key issues that he addresses in the later parts of this work. The earlier parts of the work, though, are fascinating in their own right and somewhat less studied, but absolutely crucial. So, for example, he writes as follows. And last time we had a 0 to 10 overly simplistic scale. Did we do that? Did we do a scale? No? Okay. It was a different group. Sorry. On a scale, you can kind of map this. And just, if 0 is mankind being pitiful, pathetic, animalistic, beastly, and all that, and 10 is the crown jewel creation. Again, it's a little bit of a simplistic measure, but tell me where you'd place him as we read through. So he writes, and this is the law of man. No man of Israel should say in his heart, who am I, and what is my ability to effect with my insignificant actions any impact on the world? Rather, He should understand, know, and establish in the thoughts of his heart that the details of all his actions, words, and thoughts at all moments are not lost, God forbid. For each one ascends in accordance with its roots to effect its impacts in the upper spheres. And in truth, an intelligent and wise individual who truly understands this, his heart will stammer inside him with fear, trembling, when he places upon his heart that his evil acts, God forbid, to what extent reach, that they ruin and destroy through even a minor sin, far worse than the destruction wrought by Nebuchadnezzar and Titus. All right, 0 to 10. What do you got?
10.
What? That's it? You only give him a 10?
I was going to say.
Well, you can go. You can think outside the box here. You can go for 11, 12, 12.5.
I actually don't know if I agree, because I feel like it's like, yes, he ends with saying that like your ability to like impact the world is huge. Mm-hmm. It's as with your sin, you have this, you can wrought destruction greater than Nebuchadnezzar and Titus. Okay, but it seems like he's responding to something. I mean, like, it's not like some of the earlier writings that we read where it was like, man is supreme, because they couldn't conceive of there being anything outside of man. Like, it was like, you know, they didn't have a concept of man's insignificance. The only concept they had was man's significance and man's greatness. Right. So man is great because there isn't anything else.
Right.
He's responding to, it seems like, a concept that man is not. Like, he's saying that, you know, don't think man is insignificant. He's great. Like, so to me, that's not a 10. That's still something in between. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's. I don't know how to put it. Like, maybe it's a 7 or an 8 or a 6.
There's no way.
I'm just saying, it's like, I don't think it's a 10, because a 10 to me is, there's no concept of man's insignificance. He has a concept of it. He's reacting to it and saying, don't think you're insignificant. You actually, like, have grace, but he's not saying that you're more important than other beings, which is sort of what we've said previously, where man is supreme over everything. Everything else is insignificant.
Right.
He's not saying everything else is insignificant in comparison to man. He's just saying.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, yeah, Scott, go ahead.
I just want to pick up on what Robin says there. It's really, there's a scale, because it's more potential. This is what man could be. This is what you could be.
Ah, interesting.
But it's not necessarily reflecting reality. The reality may be a 5 or a 4.
Interesting. There are multiple scales.
There's this range.
The potential and actual. So good. Okay.
I don't know if that's what he intended by saying that.
Right.
But that's what I'm you know, that's what I'm feeling from him.
Right.
Because he's not actually coming to say, like, all men are, all people are
right.
at this level.
Mm-hmm.
You have the potential to be at this level if you.
Mm-hmm. Right. Fascinating. That's a great point. And then to come back to what Robin said, I think that's really helpful, because I think what you see is, it's true that he's trying to place man, right, on this pedestal, and he does. But the very fact that he needs to fight this fight and to speak out about it itself, I think, is a sign of the changing times. And that this is a question that's out there, and therefore he feels the need. Right, it's the same reason that I'm giving this series. You know, I don't know if this would have been a subject a thousand years ago, because it is what it is, right? You know, there isn't necessarily that much to talk about, you know? And so here, now it's more complex. So I think that's great. And that's a great point as well. I'll just add, I didn't give you the full, he goes on for quite some time, but just to give you a sense, he develops a fascinating theology in which he essentially ascribes omni-significance to our actions, both positive and negative. He says, if you think that your actions only impact what you can see physically before you, says, you're gravely mistaken. In fact, when we perform a mitzvah, we create some sort of celestial world. Very hard to, he draws heavily from the Zohar in describing and exploring this. Because you build some sort of heavenly sphere or creation. Sometimes he says they are physical beings or entities or buildings or some sort, or worlds that you're building. Sometimes he calls them angels. Says you're actually creating angels who then advocate on your behalf. That's a theme that perhaps we've heard before. Right? Your mitzvot create these angels who then go before God, as it were, at the throne of glory, the Kisei HaKavod, and they say, look, in so-and-so, I'm his, right? I'm here because of him or her. And so advocate for that individual and be here for them. So that's sort of one possibility. The alternative is all right, is that if we violate Averot, so then we are destructive, not just here on this earth, but there's all sorts of cosmic effect, negative effect, to our behaviors and angels who come to antagonize against us before God. So it's this whole theology, I think it's partly having to do with the place of man. I think it's also having to do with the breakdown of, he's starting to see Haskalah. I think it's the beginning of a breakdown in religious society. And I think the notion of commitment to mitzvot is, for the first time, not taken for granted within now our communities that in the previous hundreds of years. And so I think what he's trying to advocate for is, this isn't just sort of, you do it, you don't, you're in the system, not in the system. Understand that there are all sorts of ramifications that we human beings can't begin to comprehend if we don't understand the significance of that heavenly world. So I think that is perhaps also sort of an underlying factor in his need to speak out about this. I think that's part of the context as well.
I think we might be able to come close to understanding this, I would say for myself, when somebody, either very close friend or someone who we admire a lot, mm-hmm. dies. And I know that I've experienced it. At that moment, through the funeral, shiva, so I do feel that the world is bereft. Mm. I felt that.
Interesting.
And I that something has changed. That something has changed qualitatively. Not just with my life, but with my friend. But I wonder if that, like when the love died, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's.
That there's something cosmic,
yeah,
and you can begin to kind of somehow sense in a larger sense. Okay. All right. So that's one modern response, which is, right, which is to push back as hard as we can and to put man right back up there. But the truth is, if you go all the way back, and we know about it, we'll circle back in terms of Genesis. And we know we alluded to the Lonely Man of Faith last time, and we'll have to circle back to Rav Soloveitchik as well. But it's not just the different, and we're going to elaborate that, but it's not just the different presentations in the book of Genesis and Bereishit, but there are other examples of this phenomenon where I think we find traditionally, and some of these the Rav points to, we find this dichotomy within humanity, or this tension, this pull, that on the one hand we're part of the animal kingdom, and yet at the same time we're qualitatively different, and there are aspects of man that are pulled in both directions, and that to some extent both these sort of pre-modern and the modern findings have legitimacy to them, and that even if you go all the way back to the beginnings of our tradition, there are hints of this idea that really we partake of both in one way or another. And I want to share some examples of that. Take a look at Tehillim. And the Rav pointed to this, right, under the Nefesh HaChayim. And these two psukim are back-to-back. He says, just one more pasuk there, one second. I cut one pasuk off, I just want to pull up to it. I should have given you one pasuk before that. Let me start from pasuk hey, and then we'll pick up with two pasukim here. So Tehillim Perachet pasuk hey. So David HaMelech writes, Ma enosh ki tizkerenu. What is this man that you should recall him? Uven adam ki tifkedenu. And the son of man that you should pay any heed to him. Why should be any attention to this man? He's a zero. He's a nothing. Right? Like Avraham Avinu says, Anochi afar va'efer. Dust, dirt, I'm a zero. And then immediately following, literally, without, I'm not skipping, zero words, Pasuk Vav, here on the Shibayt Chasrehu Ma'at Me'elokim. Right? It this is what we call, this is, right, what would you grade this if you got it, right, what would you write on your English paper?
Inconsistent.
Inconsistent, okay? Non sequitur, okay? Right? I mean, right? A zero, a go, right? What was that? A gornished, right? So say, that's what they used to say in the Yeshiva of Nevarzak. Right, my father was born in the town of Nevarduk, actually, after the war. Yeshiva and Nevarduk, they used to, there was a Musar Yeshiva, which had a very negative undertone to it. And so they used to walk around saying that they're zeros, that they're nothings. So, ich bin a gornish, I'm nothing. Do you guys know the joke? I tell this, that they tell that there were students in the yeshiva. They used to have these exercises. They would walk around repeating. They would go, walk into a corner and debase themselves, embarrass themselves, and they would chant, ich bin a gornish, ich bin, I'm a nothing, I'm a nothing, I'm a nothing. That was their approach to Musar. It was their philosophy. So it was the new students, the new kid on the block. So he came to the yeshiva and enrolled, and he sat off in the corner, and even louder than all the others, ich bin a gornish, ich bin a gornish. Nothing, I'm a nothing, I'm a nothing. So the guys who've been in the yeshiva for some time, they turn to each other and say, this guy just got here yesterday, he thinks he's such a gornish. So, you know, it's human nature is what it is. But that was one philosophy. And the other philosophy of Musar had the opposite approach. And that was the yeshiva of Slobodka and the altar of Slobodka, and that was to emphasize not the lowliness of humanity, but just the opposite. The greatness, and they used to dress all spiffy. The yeshiva students had this notion. We have this nowadays, yeshiva students are all dressed up. That came, there were some yeshivas, they were not well off. They could all dress, you know, nicely. I mean, it, you know, for them, when they were wearing the hat and the getup and all of that, it was, that was really, you know, not quite royalty, but at that time, that was really, that was spiffy at that time. And so that's what they were trying to accomplish. So in the Musar Yeshivos, you have different sort of philosophies. You have the Nevarduk approach, the Slobodka approach, different schools of thought. But if you look at the original verses here, right, they're interwoven. You made him just a little bit lower than God, and you adorned him with honor and with glory, right? Right, you allowed him to have memshala, like we read in Bereshit, right, that you rule over the animal kingdom, right? So you gave him to have dominion over the works of your hands, and put all things under his feet. So the pasuk really seems to, again, it seems contradictory, but I think that's exactly the point. And I think that the vav here in pasuk vav, how would you translate that? Right? If it's first ma'anoshki tizkerenu, and then it's vatchasrehu ma'at me'elokin. So how would we translate that? Sure. Would you? So I wouldn't translate that as and necessarily. Right? Oh, here they go. Okay, if you look at the translation they have here, how do they translate it? Okay, it's the chichi. And that's what I would say as well, yet. Okay, this is from the official, those who were here last week, we introduced Safaria, which is this new online open text that they're adding text all the time, Hebrew and English. And you can use it to make source sheets, and it's a really fascinating kind of project. I encourage everyone to take a look. Sefaria.org, and this is whoever did their English translation. It is probably mixed. It's not quite the JPS translation, but they also say yet. So I think that there's that tension you find here as well. And I'd like to actually push it ahead a little bit. I'm actually going to skip over for just a moment. And if you take a look now, I wanted to point out this time of year, that if you jump for just a moment, this tension is present as well in our Yom Kippur davening. So I did this, came in a little bit backward. Actually, if you go to the last sheet, 1 second. Yeah, we're going to read it. It's going to come backward a little bit. Like that. So go to the end, and then we're going to come back. You'll see it comes back forward. It just reads more easily this way. So it's fascinating. Take a look at the bottom of page 786. Okay, and then we'll come back toward the front of the sheets. 786 on the bottom, Atanotain. Have that all the way in the back. So here we read, so where this is Ne'ilah, right? This is the apex of our prayers on Yom Kippur. Okay, so this is probably going to be a significant liturgical text, if there is one in the Jewish tradition. And this is Ni'ilah, right? So this is our private Shemona Esrei, our private Amidah during Ni'ilah. So after we conclude Shemona Esrei, right, or Yul Ratzon at the end, right, we add the Ashamnus, and then what do we say? So we say, Atanotin Yada Poshim V'Minchab Shuta L'Kabel Shavim. You, God, you accept sinners, right, you extend your right hand to accept those who repent. But Slamdenu Hashem Elokinu Litvadot Lefanacha. You taught us, O God, to perform Vidoy, to confess before you. I'll call Avonotenu for all of our sins. Why? Lema'an Nechdal Mi Oshek Yadenu. Do you have it? There?
That's
starting in backwards, right?
Yeah, that's
not. Really?
I've got it right here.
It doesn't have it? I don't know. I'm on 788 now.
It doesn't count.
If you come
backwards.
It's backwards. That's just that it's backwards. Just easier to read that way. L'man nechtal mi'oshek yadenu, so that we can withdraw our hands from theft. So if you continue this paragraph, so he says, I'm now in the fourth line in the Hebrew, V'ata yodel, God, you know. Again, the height of Ni'ilah, you know. She'achritinu rimavitoliyah, that our end, our conclusion will be, right? We're going to be... Right, we're going to be nothings. We're going to be worms. Right, we're going to be right. We're going to be these little beasts. L'fichach yirbeitas lichatinu. That's why you increased for us the possibility of atonement, because you knew that we're not up for very much. I mean, we don't have much going for us. Look at our ends. Ma'anu. This is familiar from brachot or karbanot, right? Ma'anu mechayenu mechastenu ma'tzidkenu ma'yishuatenu ma'kochenu ma'gvuratenu. This is, by the way, a literary. This is right. This is right. There's clearly. I actually remember one chazon that I remember just the way that he read this section was repeating Shemona Esrei always stuck with me. He said each one. He said in exactly the same way. Instead of you, sometimes a chazan will each one will say differently because usually it gets boring. So skilled chazanim will typically vary their, just like a skilled speaker will vary the modality of the speaking. So too a skilled chazan will also up and down and to keep everyone engaged and interested or just sort of participating in the tefillah, a really, really talented chazan will make sure to sort of change the nuances of how they formulate each phrase. But this chazan, whether intentionally or unintentionally, didn't. Everyone was the same. So they said, Ma'anu, Mechayenu, Mechastenu, Matzidkenu, Ma'yeshuatenu, Ma'kochenu. That's not typical. Usually you kind of change each one. Yeah, but it stuck with me because that's exactly what the phrases are doing. There's that the repetition. It's a literary tool, and the motif of what are we, like an echa type of repetition, is very prominent here. Manumar lefanecha Hashem Elokeinu Elokeinu. What are we going to say before you? Hello, kol yiborim kain lefanecha. Even the great human beings, they're like zero before you. Anshe Hashem kelohi. You all these people of outstanding reputations, stature, right? Anshe Shame, right? Everyone knows about who they are. Kilo, they're as if they were nothing. They're zeros. V'chachamim kivlimada. All the wise, right? The wise. It's like they have no knowledge. Unvonim kivliaskel kivrov ma'asayim. It's a zero. There's nothingness. It just amounts to empty, the same emptiness as the beginning of creation. Michayim heva lefanecha. Right? Mataradam nahabehema ayin. Be a complete sheer without some Kohelet reference. Right? Right? The preeminence. I like this translation here. The preeminence of man over beast is non-existent. Kia kol havel. Right? There's nothing there. Okay. So that's a pretty right. That's down near. That's a zero, one, two, whatever it is. Right on our scale. And then again, okay, Emily, what are you going to write here? Right? Yeah, there you go. They go. What are they saying? Nevertheless, atahiv dalta no shmei rosh. Right? You set apart man from the beginning. Vataki rehama amod lefanecha. You recognize him to stand before you. Who's going to tell you what to do? And you gave this to us, be'ahava, right, with love, right, and so on and so forth. So this is, again, this is bizarre. If someone handed this in, right, as a paper or some sort of essay of some sort, I mean, we'd mark it confusing, right? Go back to the drawing board, yeah.
The transitional, just to be technical for a second,
yeah.
The transitional word, nevertheless, saves it from being a non sequitur. what I would say if this were handed in as an essay is give examples. But the, nevertheless, right. Saves it from being.
The paper doesn't have
here it's I even, mean, right, here it's even,
that's
it's just, even.
That's being added because that's
being added, interpreted.
Right.
But it's
that's
not
true.
In the.
And that's absolutely right. And it's different than the psukim and tilim in that regard. That's a great point. Yes. In tilim, you have the vav, which is ambiguous. You could translate it and, but you could translate it and yet. And it seems reasonable enough. But Scott, you're right. Here it's
no,
just. It's just you're kind of guessing. You're just kind of guessing. 100%. Yeah. Just as an aside, I'll just mention, because I think it's just a nice thought for Yom Kippur, for Ni'ilah, the top of 788, if you just go back there, L'ma'a nechdal mi'oshek yadinu. So just as an aside, it says that God gave us the opportunity of repentance so as to, we can, they translate, we can withdraw our hands from theft. So I think they made, this is actually copied from the Rav's Machzor, so it's probably here somewhere. I think it is. So the Rav has a beautiful thought on this. He says, we're at the height of the Ilah and we're confessing our sins and we're explaining that we're not worthy and God therefore gave us the opportunity of tshuva so that what? We can save ourselves from the sin of theft. So wait, this is, of all the sins of mankind, and there are just a handful that we could probably creatively come up with that are plausible, the one sin that we happen to identify as this is the reason, that, right, the reason that of all tshuva is so as to save mankind from theft. That doesn't make very much sense. So the Rav said, that's not what it means. It doesn't mean the sin of stealing something else. What it means is the misappropriation of ourselves. That if we engage in sinful activity, we are engaging in theft of ourselves because we ourselves are here on loan in order to fulfill a mission in line with God's will. And so therefore, the very act of sinfulness of any sort is indeed an act of theft, an act of oshek. And so that's ultimately what this passage is trying to communicate. So just as an aside. But just to come back to the larger point. So you have this tension and you have this dichotomy and they're put together in ways that are confusing, but I think intentionally so, to show that this is mankind. We're all of that all at the same time in Tehillim and here at the height of Ni'ilah as well. Okay. Now, just to push it a little bit further, it's fairly widely known that that the modern thinker who really brought this to our attention, perhaps more prominently than any other, was Rav Soloveitchik. This was already mentioned last class, and I'd like to begin to unpack some of his philosophy, and we'll continue that and some other aspects of this next time as well. So first, take a look back at page number 3, Majesty and Humility. So we're going to look at a few pieces from the Rav. We're going to look at 3, actually, or excerpts from 3. Majesty and Humility was published as an article by the Rav. I believe it was published in 1978 in the Journal of Tradition. There was a summer edition in which the Rav published five essays concurrently, all at the same time. So literally the edition was Joseph Soloveitchik, Joseph all the way through. And the Soloveitchiks were not big on publishing. His whole family tradition was deeply perfectionist. His grandfather, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, famously was extremely hesitant to actually put things to print, and so they say that his commentary of novella of Chidushim on the Rambam was he went over every single word and the fine tooth comb and make sure every single nuance was exactly what he had in mind. And so that's the kind of tradition that he comes from, and so he was not a big publisher in his life, and so when he did have something to write, he really meant it. He really felt that it was really his best work. And so in that piece, he distinguishes between he calls 2 kinds of man. The Rav would very often work with typologies, right? Very often we know in the right dichotomies, right? Do you wanna elaborate?
No, I feel like that's goes through everything. It's always, I guess it's like from Rambam. He always has, I mean, we talk about it from, you know, the 2 Adam, you know, 2 versions of Adam. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you know, he says majesty and humility, it's the both, and he always brings together, like, you know, the height of the two points, and mm-hmm. it sort of finds the dialectic to something mm-hmm. that needs to struggle with.
Right, and so that's exactly, so the Rebbe will very often do exactly that, very nicely said, and he'll set up two pure types. And of course, neither type exists in reality. They're sort of, they're poles on a spectrum. And what he's suggesting is that all people, all human beings combine to some extent, we all fall somewhere along this spectrum, but we all have both of these aspects within us. In particular, he does that in context of our topic. The Rebbe was very much drawn to this struggle, this question as to the place of humanity, modern man in particular, where do we fit in? And how are we like and unlike the animals, and how are we like and unlike the cosmos, and where do we fit in to all of this, and how do we elevate ourselves sort of so that if we have the struggle within us, so how do we resolve that tension in hopefully a positive way, and how does that tension play itself out? So he constantly revisits this theme. I'm just giving three examples. There are many, many more. These are just some cases in point. So the first one here is majesty and humility. So he distinguishes between what he calls cosmic man, on the one hand, who is man who is both drawn from and connected to the cosmos and also engaged by the cosmos and constantly exploring the world out there and trying to understand it, on the one hand. And the other one he calls, in this context, right, that's majesty, that's majestic man. The other one is humble man. And over here, in this context, he's going to refer to that person as origin-minded man. Interesting phrase. Origin-minded man. Okay, what does that mean, right? Constantly thinking about our origin. What is our origin? Alright, okay. Nothing much to write home about, or so it would seem, although you could say Tzelem Elokim, etc., but that's not what he has in mind here. And so that's the tension. Majestic man, humble man. So the Rav writes as follows: as we have stated above, cosmic man beholds the vision of God in infinity, in the endlessness of the distance which separates him from God. Well, origin-minded man experiences God in his closeness to man as a rule. In times of joy and elation, one finds God's footsteps in the majesty and grandeur of the cosmos, in its vastness, its stupendous dynamics, when man is drunk with life, when he feels that living is a dignified affair. Then man beholds God in infinity. In moments of ecstasy, God addresses himself to man through the twinkling stars and the roar of the endlessly distant heavens. Lord my God, thou art great, thou art clothed with glory and majesty. In such moments, majestic day, or as majestic man, even the vast universe is large enough to accommodate, addresses itself to happy man. And this is where the Rav sometimes moves from prose to poetry. Right? It becomes lyrical in the middle of his writing. However, with the arrival of the dark night of the soul, in moments of agony and black despair, when living becomes ugly and absurd, plainly nauseating, when man loses his sense of beauty and majesty, God addresses him not from infinity, but from the infinitesimal. Not from the vast stretches of the universe, but from a single spot in the darkness which surrounds suffering man from within the black despair itself. 11 years ago, my wife lay on her deathbed. I watched her dying, day by day, hour by hour. Medically, I could do very little for her. All I could do was to pray. However, not pray at the hospital. Somehow I could not find God in the whitewashed long corridors among the interns and the nurses. However, the need for prayer was great. I could not live without gratifying this need. The moment I returned home, I would rush to my room, fall on my knees, pray fervently. God in those moments appeared not as the exalted, majestic king, but rather as a humble, close friend, brother, father. In such moments of black despair, he was not far from me. He was right there in the dark room. Felt his warm hand, kviyachol, on my shoulder. I hugged his knees, kviyachol. He was with me in the narrow confines of a small room, taking up no space at all. God's abiding in a fenced-in, finite locus manifests his humility and love for man. In such moments, humilitas Dei, which resides in the humblest and tiniest of places, addresses itself to man. Stuff.
Yeah.
man who can find God in the darkness.
He's working. He's not just waiting to find God in the darkness. He's praying fervently. He's trying to connect.
And he said that there. Yeah, I think it's fascinating that he's so frank. He says, I tried in the hospital, and there was nothing. Like, have you ever heard of someone, or maybe someone felt this himself? I've heard this from multiple people. Went to the Kotel for the first time. It's a totally different scenario. I don't mean to compare, but someone who was, in other words, someone who was at a moment they thought they could find connection, a very different kind of example, and it's just a blank. And then they wrestle with themselves. This was supposed to be a moment of connection. This case in tragedy, obviously, in a very painful and difficult scenario for the Rav. So I think the fact that he's so honest about it just wasn't happening here, but it did happen somewhere else, I think is heartening, and I think is interesting as part of that struggle.
I hear he's sort of speaking. I mean, I guess he's speaking about God's majesty and humility, not
mm-hmm.
really man's majesty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The one reflects the other.
He's finding moments of connection during dark times, putting this incredible grandeur, like seeing the awe of God. This is not.
No, I think
seeing God in a very simple way, but it's so profound.
Is that to say that one? What is the connection to God in this cosmic sense? Are you saying that you really don't connect on this primal, intimate level? Because it's just grand and majestic, and you know, not only comes in times of joy and something, and then, heavens open up, and somehow that's a connection, but it's not the same kind of connection. Or don't we ascribe to that being mm-hmm. so standing on the beach and moons coming up over the ocean and
right.
celestial bodies, there's something profound about that.
Absolutely.
Why is this almost makes that seem
trite. Yeah, I agree. Maybe that's just not his.
Mm-hmm. Majesty is the one you fear. The humility is the one you love. Mm-hmm. So in terms of, you're not supposed to have confidence. It's not that we need to connect with him in the same way from both places. It's
you can
grand
see
as majesty.
You can see the majesty and be totally humble about that. I mean, it can be this awesome
experience.
It makes
you feel humble.
Yeah.
Right. This is not directly what we're talking about, but I'm always so awed by his honesty and his emotions.
Why do you think it's on the sheet as opposed to he wrote about it very
for a man in that generation.
I'm not sure what you're trying to say, Franny.
It's like a public forum. I mean, it's really impressive.
But I think you're right. I mean, I think that we're struck by it. But it was. I don't get the impression that when you read about how people describe him interpersonally, people don't describe him as being warm and cuddly.
Not at all.
He was pretty stark, apparently. I mean, apparently, like.
With his students, he was very severe.
Right, that's what I hear. I mean, but his.
Very different outside of his sheer context. He was a very. He came across completely differently.
I thought he was also known for, like, great acts of chesed. That's also.
Mm-hmm. That's an important separate conversation about the Rav. Some interesting recent writing about this. How do we remember the Rav? What does that reflect about our values as a community? Some really interesting things. Do we call the Rav a tzaddik? In the sense that when we think about a tzaddik, what is that? I don't think we think about scholarship or genius or any of that. We think about sort of. Right, it's connected somehow to chesed, but not just chesed on a basically somehow something much, the taking that and on a grand scale of some sort. His grandfather, the tzaddik of Yerushalayim, that's kind of the image that we have, going to the prisons and all of that. And the fact that the Rav had that in his biography, and yet that's not what we focus on, is that cause for reflection as a community? Yes, is my opinion. Some interesting things about that written recently. But yeah, I think it's fascinating. It's not just, we could talk about the gender piece and the generational, the sort of the historical piece, but there's a particular contextual point for the Rav himself, which makes this all the more powerful, because this was counter to his family tradition. His family was extremely closed. They did not talk personally at all. His grandfather was famous for this. His father wasn't very different. They didn't share their personal experiences with their children. They didn't share it with their students. Rav Chaim walked into shir. He opened up the Gemara. There was no small talk. When his children came, they would... I mean, these are at least the stories they tell. I'm sure there was some sort of chatting. They were normal, healthy, well-adjusted people, I think, but they just weren't interested in chit-chat and small talk. And I don't know how Soloveitchik...
They also were community rabbis. Apparently he had a totally different personality up in...
That, say again?
The Rav had a totally different personality up in Brookline.
In Brookline.
In the city where...
So his great-grandfather...
His relationship with his Talmidim was very different.
Very interesting. Right. But in terms of opening up, in other words, the Rav himself, maybe yes, but his... But in his family...
They weren't proper rabbis.
His interesting. Okay, his grandfather, that's true. His father was a Rav, though. And his great-grandfather, the Beis HaLevi, also was a Rav. I don't think that they were known for that. But yes, I mean, certainly an American pulpit was also very different, a different set of responses. The whole pastoral piece for the Eastern European rabbis wasn't really, you know, there's... it just wasn't the same. I actually heard a story, it's a little bit of a sad story, about a very prominent rabbi in Israel where also the pastoral piece is now becoming more of a central part. You can probably speak to this better, but historically wasn't necessarily the primary function of rabbis in communities. It tended to be more halacha and more formal functions and other things like that, but the whole pastoral piece, not so much. Very prominent rabbi, happens to be the rabbi of a large area in Israel, in his apartment building, there was a secular couple that had lost in the family, and they were trying to figure out what to do. And he basically said, "Wouldn't it be nice if we set up, you know, shiva minyan for them and all these things?" And it was a novel idea. And it was so foreign and so interesting that this was considered to be a novelty. And it was just, he happened to someone in the building that he happened to have otherwise interacted with, and they had a loss in the family, so let's organize a shiva minyan. To me, it just speaks about how unusual, atypical that is in terms of the model of the rabbinate. So I think in Eastern Europe also that wasn't, so maybe you're right, maybe because he had that role here in America, in Brooklyn, maybe that was a piece of it. But the Rav Aaron was also
connected.
His brother.
Yes.
Uh-huh. It didn't have as... His reputation was not as severe a personality, right, for sure. He didn't have a pulpit in that sense, but he was viewed as more accessible than his older brother, for sure. So that's interesting as well. The Rav, despite the family tradition, I think it's all the more remarkable that he did open up. And there are different suggestions as to why that is. Some say he had that experience as the pulpit piece.
No, his wife seems to have been his connection to him. I mean,
he writes very movingly about it. Yeah,
his connection to her, and it was
because of a woman, basically.
Bernie
wouldn't have said it that way, but basically that's the conclusion of the women at the table.
The
isn't that convenient?
Yeah, but the way he talks about his loss of her is anybody who felt grief.
Yeah.
But his grief feels like it's so, you know, encompassed. The fact that he was able to have this grief and live, you know, and the challenges that he talks about, you know, when Halacha and suffering, when he talks about just dealing with suffering.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. I think that is the part of that as well. Another suggestion that's been offered in addition to his sort of personal experiences and his professional responsibilities is just this larger sense that he he wasn't connecting, or that there was sort of a need for a different approach with this generation of Jews living in America, and that the dry intellectual piece they could get that, but just somehow that wasn't what they needed, and it wasn't enough. And this is something that Rav struggled with, even with his smaller circles of students. That Rav struggled with this. He wrote openly about this as well. He says, on the analytical piece, I taught my students the method of Talmud study, how to learn a block Gemara, and how to approach a Rambam, and how to approach a Ravid, and a Rashi, and a Tosas, and all that. I feel very comfortable that I achieved all of my standards for myself in that regard. He said, but there's some soul that's missing somehow. The spirit of Judaism that I grew up with in my home, somehow I feel that I may have failed to convey that. There's a summer study group that he led in Boston one year, and he shocked them. For the Rav, this is shocking. He said, we're not pulling out a Gemara today. Instead, or before we pull out a Gemara, we're going to start learning Chassidus. He pulls out something, I think, from the Alter Rebbe, from Rav Schneur Zalman Liad, you mentioned earlier, the founding Chassidic Rebbe of Lubavitch, of Chabad, and he opens one of the Sefer and he starts learning with his students. Their jaws dropped, and this is the sign of Lithuanian Judaism. This is a solid piece. You know, he accidentally was learning with the Lubavitcher Melamed when he was growing up in Chaslavich, when he was about six. They had a Melamed, and they were in, it was up in White Russia, and there was a Misnaged community, and there was a heavy Chabad community there present. And apparently word got back to Rav Moshe, the Rav's father, that Melamed was teaching the Rav Tanya. Tanya. This is the grandson of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. He's six, he better be learning Gemara. I mean, really. Bittelsman. And Rav Moshe was so upset about it that he fired the Melamed. He and his wife had some disagreement about it, but ultimately he won her over, and they decided, that's it, done, the end. And Rav Moshe took personal responsibility for the studies of his son, and they studied together from the time the Rav was 7 to 19. 12 years learning with his father, and that helped his development significantly. He was homeschooled until he went to the University of Berlin at the age of 19 to pursue his doctorate. But the Rav wrote that although it was all a big mistake and his father would have none of it, he said that was an incredibly formative experience for him. I don't know if he ever told that to his parents, but or his father, but it was incredibly powerful for him, and he always loved learning Tanya, and it always was something that stuck with him, and it's something that he came back to at later points in life. So the Rav really struggled with this, and I think that this is really an educational decision to some extent, despite his background, that somehow he felt like there was something else that needed to be done, and a different way of going about this, and I think that was really part of what was motivating him as well. Alright, we're going to stop here for this evening. Next week, actually, we have a conflict. I hope this works for people's schedules. We have back to school night Wednesday night because of various scheduling issues. We had to schedule it then. We're moving it to Tuesday night. I'm going to put it in email, but I wanted to let you know. I hope that works for your... I hope that works for your schedules. If it doesn't, I apologize. But
all the holidays are on Wednesday night. Are we just skipping them?
We are the Wednesday. There's a Wednesday night in between.
There's
a Wednesday night in between. Yeah, it's the three. So those are what they are. But I wanted to make sure we still have next week. So Tuesday night, regular time here, and we'll continue with the Rav and some other interesting surprises as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.